This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Right. Just like as a physicist, everyone expected me to be great at pool, and I was always terrible at it. Just because I understand how it works doesn't mean I'm good at it.
Now, here's your host.
Hi, I'm Darzy Handelar of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, standing, or rather sitting in for Mike Petrelli here at the Education Gadfly Show. You can find us online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Kathleen Porter McGee of Education Policy. That's how great she is, Kathleen Porter McGee.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's fun to be here co-hosting with you, Dara.
No problem. This is the all-female Gadfly podcast. We are super excited. And I know that here at Fordham, we have our NCAA March Madness office pool. Do you have a strategy?
You know, I don't usually have a strategy, although we come from a grand tradition of Jesuit education and Jesuit schools. And so my dad often uses the, when in doubt, the Jesuit school wins strategy. And maybe in honor of the Pope, we should do that this year.
Got it. I used to be very non-scientific about it. I went with mascots or school colors or schools that I've attended because there's been a lot of them, lots of rounds through grad school. But now, as a statistician, I feel like I have a foolproof strategy, which is do whatever Nate Silver tells me to do. So my picks are his.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense.
And now we are going to tone down the madness. It's time to play Pardon the Gadfly.
In the latest dust-up over Common Core, the inclusion of some arguably violent picture books in New York's third grade English curriculum has some arguing that the standards have been implemented too quickly. Is that the case?
So this is interesting. So basically, New York City Department of Education released a list of recommended programs for its schools, and they went through and they looked for programs that were reasonably aligned to the Common Core. The reason they did this, actually, is because New York State is being pretty thoughtful and intentional about building a Common Core aligned curriculum, and it's going to take a long time for it to be finished. And so I feel like we're getting at them in both ways. New York State is trying to take its time, and they were being criticized, I think, by some in the field who needed resources right away. And so New York City stepped in and said, well, here are some that we think are reasonably good. They're not mandatory. They were given options. I really don't think that this is a major issue. I think that the programs, I'm sure none of them is perfect. Maybe there are some books that are inappropriate for students, but nobody's being mandated to read any of them. I think that it seems like New York State and it seems like New York City is, they're trying to be thoughtful and they're trying to do this right. They're taking the long view, but they're also trying to get things into the hands of schools right away. So I think this is a lot of noise, but I'm not sure there's a major problem.
So this could be an example of something being brought up by opponents of the Common Core is just an example of, well, here's something that you're not doing properly, but really this is grasping at straws.
Yeah, it seems like it is. I mean, the other thing that always worries me, too, is when we start picking apart books, it starts to feel like language police, book burning things. I don't know. I've never read these stories myself again. But I get really nervous when we start picking apart optional curriculum and trying to ban stories from them.
And this is a pervasive, decades-old issue. In my experience in Southern California, I sat through school board meetings where they were talking about really important budget issues and teaching issues, and nobody said boo. And then what really got the attention of people was whether In Cold Blood was an appropriate optional text for an AP English course. And then that's when you had the lines out the door of public comment. So, perhaps a bit of straw grasping in any case. Question two.
According to a new Brookings report, there's been a surge in the use of student tracking and ability grouping at the elementary school level. Is this a good thing?
I don't have a good answer for this. I struggle with this all the time. My big worry about tracking and ability grouping in elementary level is that it ends up hurting poor and minority kids, because if you're tracking in kindergarten, first or second grade, you're often going to be tracking into the lower groups, the students who are more disadvantaged in their early years. And so I've got a real problem with it. On the other hand, I am sensitive to the fact that there are some students who we really want to be stretching and we want to be pushing. But I think from the policy level, I think that the dangers of grouping our most disadvantaged kids, and tracking them into a lower track from the beginning is too great.
And from a research perspective, studies really are just now beginning to touch on the social aspects of tracking. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you've got the academic aspects, and is it better for the lower performers? Is it better for the higher performers? But the social aspects of tracking have really largely been neglected. Mm-hmm. And especially when you're talking about elementary school students, where they spend their entire day with the same group of students, mm-hmm. what kind of negative impact are you getting when you group for the entire day all of the lower ability and the higher ability students together? Perhaps it's less of an issue in high school, where if you track, you only have 40 minutes with the same group of students, and then you have more social interaction in the cafeteria or in your other courses. But I do worry about the social and developmental aspects of tracking, and I really encourage the research to tie that to academic progress.
The other thing that I would say, I think I've seen some studies recently that found in the UK, I believe, that at the elementary level, students who are more likely to be tracked into the higher ability groups were the older students. And so there's also a developmental issue. I mean, it's almost, it reminded me of the outliers, you mm-hmm. know, the 10,000 hours thing. I mean, if you're automatically tracking students who were born in, you know, whatever, January into the highest groups because they're older and they just have had more, you know, they're more developmentally ready for things. I don't, that's a major issue as well. So until we get better at being able to track and being able to really identify what it means to be gifted versus just having exposure to more stuff, I think it's something we should steer clear of.
Agreed. Question three.
In states where school attendance is not compulsory until age 6 or 7, chronic absenteeism is rampant among 4-year-olds. Is this a problem?
Well, I mean, not necessarily, right? I mean, I don't know. I guess it depends on whether it's disproportionately affecting, our most disadvantaged students. I mean, for my part, I've got 4-year-olds, and if I choose to keep them home from school to do something that's enriching, I feel like that's my right as a parent right now. So I think it depends on where the problem is really focused. And is it that, again, our most disadvantaged students are losing out on things? Or is it that parents are taking advantage of their right to, you know, nurture their kids in different ways?
All right. I think it's very dependent not only on the type of academic enrichment our students or these kids getting that when they are not in school. But also, when you're talking about socioeconomically disadvantaged students, if these are students that are enrolled in school breakfast and lunch programs, that if they are not attending school, then this is a nutrition problem as well as an education problem. So my research hat is constantly on. And again, I encourage, researchers to really look at the effects of, we talk a lot about absenteeism in high school and FaceTime with teachers and how that can affect student achievement, but what does it mean for a 4- and 5-year-old to be absent from school, and what sorts of activities are they engaging in when they're not there?
And I also think we should be careful about, if that is a problem, how we correct for it, because I don't think the correction for that problem is to make compulsory education go younger and younger, because I think there are some very legitimate reasons that parents might choose to keep their kids home from school when they're that age.
That's it for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everybody's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome, Amber.
Thank you, Dara.
Kathleen and I were talking about our NCAA March Madness strategies.
Oh, boy.
Do you have one?
I have not participated, shamefully, in the Fordham March Madness pool in the 5.5 years that I've been here.
Why?
Because I have no clue.
You don't need
no
to have
clue.
A clue.
I've always felt a lot of pressure because as a researcher and a statistician, everyone expects me to be good at it.
I know it, right?
Just like as a physicist, everyone expected me to be great at pool, and I was always terrible at it. Just because I understand how it works doesn't mean I'm good at it.
Yeah.
But as I was telling Kathleen, my strategy is to choose Nate Silver's bracket.
I feel like I need to participate this year, just just to be in the camaraderie of it all. And I read in the paper this morning, just choose the three top seeds and carry them through. And I'm thinking, well, now I need to find out who those are.
But then you
got to
pick upsets, right? I mean, you get bonus points for correctly picking right. upsets, and it makes it upsets. So much more fun in the early rounds.
Well, yeah. Clearly we know which one out of the three of us is going to do the best.
That's right.
What do you have for us this week, Amber?
Oh, we've got the 2013 Brown Center Report from Brookings. This is the 12th edition by our buddy Tom Lovelace. Three parts to the study. They look at international test scores, ability grouping. You guys already talked about that. So I'm going to focus in on part three of the study, which looks at algebra in eighth grade. Lovelace uses NAEP data to examine two key research questions. One, do states that boost enrollment in advanced math classes, including algebra in eighth grade, also experience a rise in NAEP math achievement? Question two, are rising enrollments associated with lower mean achievement in advanced classes? Okay, three key results. I'm going to fly through them. First, no correlation, he finds, between states' advanced math enrollment and NAEP achievement in 2011. In other words, states with more eighth graders taking advanced math classes are no more or less likely to post a higher NAEP score in math than states with lower enrollments in those classes. Number two, he examines changes in enrollments between 2005 and 2011. So the first study was cross-sectional. Here he tries to do more of a long-term look. Finds that states with rising enrollments in advanced courses experience shrinking enrollment in basic courses, which is kind of like duh, and vice versa. 45 states, incidentally, boosted enrollment in Algebra 1 during that time, presumably as a result of state policies, i.e. California, or an equity agenda. We know there was a big equity agenda to push enrollment in those courses. No statistically significant relationship between change in course enrollment and change in NAEP score. And then he did something interesting. So instead of using composite NAEP as the achievement variable, he used the substrand algebra subscore just for algebra, which should presumably be more sensitive to picking up gains in algebra knowledge. And still, no statistically significant relationship. So states that increased the percentage of kids taking algebra or geometry in eighth grade were no more likely to post NAEP gains than states with decreased enrollment in those courses. Woo! Third, finally, boosting the percentage of students in higher level courses is associated with decreases in the mean scores in those courses in most cases. And he says, well, that's evidence of watering down achievement, which is true, but I think one thing I was left with after reading this study was that's also a good thing, right? Because presumably it means that you didn't water down the curriculum. The achievement may have gotten watered down, but the curriculum may not have, which I thought was a good thing.
Well, is it also possible that we're just looking at a repackage? I mean, if you want to say that you're offering advanced courses to more students, you just take your standard course and repackage it. And then, you know, it kind of relates back to the first finding that you mentioned, which is there's not any significant increase in their achievement, even if the increased enrollment in the advanced courses goes up.
Yeah, and that's the big thing, right? And that's sort of what we're hearing with Common Core, right? Is it just that we're slapping a different label on some of these courses? Is it that you're calling it Algebra 1, but you're giving kids, you know, 2 years to get through it?
Mm-hmm.
So really,
that's a real issue. Yeah.
I mean, I think this is a hot topic, right, in Common Core and how we handle it. And you guys know, in California, the research has been mixed. In some cases, I think I was just reading a few, just refreshing my memory. Some of the studies say this works if you have real supports in place for those kids who are struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, a real support. But other studies have found, you know, yeah, you increase the enrollments, but you have higher failure rates. You don't necessarily have higher test scores. You don't necessarily have more kids going to college. So it's sort of a mixed bag in terms of the salience of these policies.
Which begs the question, in studies like this, is a state really the appropriate unit of analysis, or should we really be looking at districts or even schools?
Yeah, that's right. Kathleen, what about Common Core? Because Tom tacked on a PS in the study, in which he said, you know, we don't know what Common Core is going to mean for gifted math kids. And isn't it possible that we need a non-common curriculum for some of these kids? So, which really didn't have any much to do with what he was talking about,
right.
But he kind of worked that in the study at the end.
So, yeah, that's a lot to digest for.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. I'm intrigued that there was no correlation between NAEP scores and advanced math, sort of state level advanced mm-hmm. math policy. That actually seems to suggest that what Common Core is doing is not as horrible as some of the anti-Common Core folks are suggesting, because they're basically arguing that, you know, we need to have the Algebra 1 in eighth grade, and to take this away is actually doing a disservice to kids. And this study seems to suggest that, no, that wasn't doing any particular service to kids to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so if the Common Core succeeds in helping kids learn the fundamentals, the basic arithmetic, and learn it really, really well, which is the focus. The focus of the Common Core is not to accelerate, but it's to go deep and to encourage real, true mastery of some of the most critical mathematical, number skills and mathematical content. And so, to me, this seems to suggest that maybe that's the right move, because our move to just accelerate everybody didn't do anything.
Yeah, so just to clarify, that he doesn't actually look at the policies of states. He just looks at enrollments in those advanced courses. But interestingly enough, clarify what it is. Common Core takes no stance on Algebra 1 in eighth grade, right?
Well, so it's, okay, yes, that's true, mm-hmm. except that if you were to follow the Common Core to the letter, I believe the way it works out is that you wouldn't be mastering all of the Algebra 1 skills by the end of eighth grade. And so that's what has some people who like accelerating math, that's what has them up in arms, because they say you should be requiring Algebra 1 by the end of eighth grade, and Common Core does not do that. That doesn't mean, by the way, just because the Common Core is a floor, mm-hmm. not the ceiling, it doesn't mean that you still can't accelerate gifted students. It doesn't mean that you still can't accelerate all students. Mm-hmm. But the focus of the Common Core is not to get everybody through Algebra 1 in eighth grade.
Right. And that's also a point that Tom makes in the study. You know, we need to think more precisely about acceleration. And are we accelerating by particular student skills, or are we accelerating by grade level? And just saying, because you hit eighth grade, you take this. And he doesn't really take a stance on that. But I think that's right. I mean, acceleration done well is individualized acceleration.
Right. Well, and also there's a question, too. I've heard somebody say that, you know, let's be careful. When we're saying we want to do enrichment and we want to make sure we're reaching our gifted and talented, that doesn't necessarily just mean going more quickly through more superficial standards. It can mean going deeper into the standards. And I think that distinction is meaningful. I think it's hard to do well, and that's mm-hmm. that puts the onus on, you know, curriculum developers to develop really good programs, and also on leaders to select the programs that are really going to meet students where they are.
Well, definitely a lot of food for thought. And thank you, Amber, for your analysis. Until next week,
I'm Kathleen Porter McGee.
And I'm Darzy Handelar for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.